Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is April 27th. You might have noticed there hasn't been a lot of you and me time on the show lately. No monologues in these Conspirathon episodes. We just get right to business. So, hi. But I wanted to break in today because I have some terrible news that I just have to share with you. I wish I didn't have to tell you. It's terrible news as far as podcasting is concerned. It's not like terrible news, like remember that movie Deep Impact? That's actually going to happen in the real world this May. It's nothing like that. It only relates to School Sucks Podcast. But I got to tell you this because I know a lot of people are anticipating the arrival of something. And, well, here's the story. Yesterday afternoon, I drove up to where Stephanie and Brian live, got there at about 6, we hung out for a while, started recording what I believed was going to be one of the most exciting and satisfying episodes of the podcast ever. Certainly, the explosive climax to which we had been building all month and all of the artwork for Conspirathon suggested that we were going here. Our conversation about the life and work and the mission or message of Stanley Kubrick, and of course some discussion and disagreement about the hidden meanings in many of his films, a show that I have wanted to do for a long time. Brian, Stephanie, and I recorded for 5 hours from 7 p.m. until midnight. Then I drove home. I didn't even go to sleep until 3 in the morning. Because I was so jazzed about what we accomplished. This morning, after I went and did all my errands, I could not wait to sit down in the computer and start editing this show to hopefully get you some of it by April 30th. It's probably going to be a three-parter, I thought to myself. 5 hours? So, unfortunately, it turns out that in Stephanie's studio, we had a problem with just one of the microphones. And for some reason, we couldn't hear it in the studio monitors while we were recording, like a crackling and a static sound. This is unprecedented what happened. What you hear through your headphones while you're recording is always been a completely reliable indication of what is going to show up in the recording. So unfortunately, everything we did last night, a conversation that probably involved, I don't know, total 25, 30 hours of preparation and research, even travel, you will never get to hear. Now, that doesn't mean that it's never going to happen. Stephanie and Brian have a pretty busy schedule over the next 2 weeks or so, so you are going to have to wait for it. We will record it sometime in May. And you know what? That's actually fitting for a show about Stanley Kubrick. That we would, you know, pour our hearts out endlessly, like an actor, only to be told that we're going to have to do the whole thing again. In fact, Stanley Kubrick often got such masterful performances out of actors and actresses by driving them to the brink of insanity. And I will tell you, when I started listening to the audio we had recorded yesterday, and I realized that this problem was all throughout the whole thing, you should have been here. It was very cinematic. I started to hear, as I skimmed through more and more of the recording, I started to hear that music from The Shining in my head as I made the same face that Shelley Duvall made in the movie when she realizes that for months her husband has just been typing the same sentence over and over again on his German typewriter in the Colorado room. But, you know, hats off to Shelley Duvall for her performance in The Shining. I thought it was masterful. I'm not going to say too much about that now. You're going to hear us talk about it. because we are going to do that show again, and we're going to do an even better job than we did the first time. And this actually brings me to the next piece of news. Oh, but before that, little postscript to that story, I did manage to salvage the first 40 minutes or so, just an introduction talking about Kubrick's background, Kubrick's style, some of the strange recurring themes in his post-1968 filmmaking career. After 2001, there's some common threads that run through his films that are very interesting. I did salvage that as a preview. It will be in the AV Club. And the audio, it's not production quality. It's not something that I wanted people who maybe were checking out the podcast for the first time to encounter and say, this is how the show sounds. But it's listenable. It was Brian's mic, so unfortunately I had to cut out some parts of Brian talking. It also kind of went in and out, so I was able to save some of it. But I can't release the show with huge chunks of Brian missing. Brian has a lot of value to add, and also the conversation wouldn't make as much sense. So you can check that out, schoolsucksproject.com/AV, or if you're already a member, all you got to do is log in and you'll see it. But anyway, yeah, this other piece of news, great news. I am in the process of moving. I've actually lived in the same place for about 2 years now, same neighborhood in the city of Manchester, New Hampshire, and it is time for a change. As you know, I am unmarried. I do not have children. I do not have a physical location that I have to show up at every day. And I like changes of scenery. So I've been where I am now for a long time for me. And I've started to want something very different. And even though I'm just telling you about this now, I've been planning it for a couple of months. I actually found a place about an hour north of where I live, kind of in the wilderness, but just a short drive from civilization. It's a large plot of land with a small house. There's a rail trail nearby, lots of woods to explore, and everything is packed up. That's why it sounds like I'm talking into a toilet bowl here. All the soundproofing is off the studio walls. I've spackled. You should have seen how many holes were in these walls, like just little holes from nails and industrial staples. Lots of spackle. So you can kind of hear my voice bouncing off the spackle of the walls. I think that's what that is. And this is the last thing that I'm doing before I pack up the big computer here. And I hope you'll bear with me over the next 2 weeks or so while I make this move. But I'm really excited to be in this new location. I've wanted to get away from cities for a while now. I wanted to live somewhere where I had better control over the noise around me. I live in a pretty densely populated area. There's people walking around outside, slamming car doors. Their car alarms go off. They giggle. Dogs barking. So I'll have a better environment for doing the show. I will have very few neighbors to worry about. I don't have to worry about bass, you know, about these people with their bass. This town that I'm moving to, very rural, not a lot of bass pumpers up there. So I'm excited about that as well. And gosh, beautiful, thick woods. I'm really excited about adventures in the woods. I think I want to shoot a bear. And not even with it, certainly not with a gun. I'm thinking a bow and arrow. And not even like a crossbow. I'm talking about an old-timey bow and arrow that I just have with me. I'm not out there to shoot the bear. I encounter the bear and one of us has to die. So I shoot it, it becomes angry, it chases me, we have like a revenant situation, not as bad as the revenant. I survive it, I get a great story, and I can stuff that bear and put it in my living room, a perfect living room for a stuffed bear. So being up in the wilderness makes a fantasy like that much more realistic, and I'll keep you posted. And the property will allow for me finally to have my own garden, something that I've talked about for a couple of years. There's great rewilding opportunities up there, and it's not too far away from my fellow conspirathoneers, Stephanie and Brian. So it will be easy for us to re-record the Stanley Kubrick Marathon Within a Thon sometime, hopefully during the first half of May. Now, the primary purpose of today's show is really just to carry those two announcements. I know people are waiting for this big conclusion to Conspirathon. You're going to have to wait a little longer. And you're also not going to hear much from me for the next 10 days because I've got a lot of work to do. But I've had this conversation for a while, and I wasn't going to post it until Conspirathon concluded. It's with somebody that I really respect and might possibly be partnering with in the future. His name is Isaac Morehouse. He's a libertarian entrepreneur, and he is also the founder and CEO of Praxis. What is Praxis? I'm going to tell you. Praxis is a one-year education program that's kind of being presented as an alternative to college. The first 2 months are spent in a kind of entrepreneurial boot camp, and then that is followed by 10 months of guided experience working inside a startup that they match you up with. So I love this idea for young people. Hey, check out the real world and participate in the process today of creating your own career instead of languishing in this artificial environment of college. And from what we've seen in the last year, that environment is becoming increasingly toxic and dangerous and anti-educational. So I think this is a fine alternative, not a sponsor yet. I would certainly entertain that idea. We've talked about it. Perfect partnership for the School Sucks project. But today, Isaac just wanted to interview me for his podcast. We talked about the history of schooling. We talked about entrepreneurship, history, conspiracy, some bigger ideas. And because there's a lot of what longtime listeners would consider review, I chopped it up a little bit and I front-loaded the portion of the discussion that I think contains the most new topics. And then for those of you who might be newer to the show, I added the first portion of the discussion after that. And then at the very end of today's presentation, I'll throw in a clip or two of this audio from the AV Club, the introduction to the Stanley Kubrick conversation. So I hope you get some value out of this conversation that I had with Isaac Morehouse. I really hope you enjoyed all of the content we produced in April. I'm really sorry I will not have this grand finale ready for you. Trust me, no one was more excited about it than me. I was really ready to invest, you know, 10, 12 hours a day the next couple days before I have to move to get at least the first part of that out to you. But that is not going to happen. So thanks for understanding. Thanks for your patience. Great stuff ahead. I'm really excited to rebuild the studio. As some of you might have noticed, the old School Sucks studio had kind of a Death Star theme. And after rewatching 2001 A Space Odyssey in preparation for these Kubrick conversations, I said, oh, maybe I'll redo the studio with a kind of Discovery One theme. You know, that's the ship that took them to Jupiter with Hal. Remember him? Oh, geez. But too white. I like to keep the room a little bit darker. So it'll probably look similar when I rebuild it. Anyway, more to come on that. Follow me on Instagram, School Sucks Project. You can maybe see some pictures of this process. So here's my conversation with Isaac Morehouse. This is his audio, so I do sound a little bit Skypey. Second part of the discussion comes first in this audio, and then the first part follows. And then at the very end, a bonus content preview, a portion of our discussion on Stanley Kubrick. Take care, everyone.
This is Isaac Morehouse. Welcome to the podcast where we discuss education, entrepreneurship, big ideas, how to put them into practice in the real world, and above all, how to live free.
I think it's really important to always keep in mind that intentions and outcomes aren't the same, and motivations for people doing certain things don't necessarily mean if someone has bad motivations, for example, what they do still may result in good. If they have good motivations, what they do still may result in bad. So it's good to see those things separately. So it's not enough to say, well, those who sort of started the system of compulsory education had, frankly, pretty unflattering and frightening motives. That alone does not prove that the schooling system is detrimental or not conducive to learning. But I think it's really important to start there to bust this myth that, well, look, maybe it doesn't work perfectly, but the reason school came about was because people needed to learn. They weren't learning. And it's really not, that's really not the genesis of it. I mean, it was actually a pretty literate country, all things considered, even at the time when these schools were implemented. But it has always been motivated by a homogenizing impulse that we want to sort of shape people into good, obedient citizens. I remember reading even our wonderful independence loving founding fathers. I remember reading some letters or essays by Benjamin Franklin, and he was really, really pushing this public school in Philadelphia. And his main reason for pushing it was because he was just so disgusted by those filthy German immigrants, and they keep speaking German, and I just want them to speak English. So let's create a free school that's too good of a deal for any of the parents to turn down, because it's going to, you know, for free, get their kids off the streets and educate them. And we'll secretly train the German out of them so that they'll stop speaking German and polluting my city with their culture that I dislike. I mean, it was really very like, I'm trying to remember what essay or letter it was, but it came across as very like, well, the motivation here is not this beneficent, like, kids aren't learning enough. No, I didn't say anything about that. It wasn't like, oh, these German kids, they don't have any opportunities. No, it was like, I want them to be more like me and to behave more like my ideal American should behave. So let's get them in and train them up. And I think that's important to understand the origins.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I, you know, going back to just the progressives, I mean, the Horace Mann, that crowd, it's a little bit harder to pin down what their real intentions were. But I think a lot of these progressives like John Dewey and a lot of these, you know, academics who came along in the early 20th century, they had the best of intentions. They thought they were saving the world, you know, even if it meant homogenization and collectivization and even making people more predictable in ultimately implementing something like the psychology of behaviorism. It was necessary for the harmonious function of society. I really believe, especially when these people were, you know, somewhat sheltered from living in the real world through academia, that they really, really believed that they were doing the right thing. I mean, that's the problem with central planning and collectivism is there's a lot of things that aren't accounted for when in your models people behave like machines and then in the real world they don't. You know, things often go awry. But I really believe, especially during the first and second big waves of immigration, that a lot of the establishment was really terrified. And would agree with Benjamin Franklin's sentiment and would agree with a lot of people today who share that sentiment about this threat of a dilution of culture or a loss of a cultural identity because of, you know, new people flooding into this country. So the concerns are valid. You know, I think that people's response or actions or rhetoric about those concerns certainly leave something to be desired for a lot of us. But they didn't see themselves as evil controllers of people. They just look that way to us, people who are more focused on individualism and see the errors of and the tragedies, really, of collectivism. But remember, too, that was pre-Soviet Union. That was pre-Nazi Germany. That was pre-Mao, pre-Great Leap Forward. So it's important to have, in my mind, and this is a point of view that took a long time for me to develop, just a touch of sympathy and understanding for that mindset 100 years ago. Because there are a lot of experiences that we can reflect on that they couldn't.
You know, I feel like there's a bit of almost a doubting of the power of self-interest in here. It kind of goes back to this Hobbesian idea that if left alone, people will all just sort of destroy each other. There's got to be some strong authority that makes sure they do the things that are good for them. Because it's like their own self-interest is not strong enough for them to figure out that, you know, it's not going to be good for them to have a society where everyone's plundering and stealing and everything is falling apart. And I think that's just a fundamentally flawed notion. I don't think you need perfect people. I just think you need to trust that people's self-interest, you know, given a context that has freedom and opportunity, is not going to drive them to destructive behaviors. They don't need an authority figure with a cattle prod at all times to make sure they sort of take care of themselves. And I think that's a fundamentally different view that goes to parenting, learning. I mean, all the aspects of society, this notion that if we didn't have some big centralized group of people with a monopoly on the use of violence, that somehow everyone would just start looting and would there be, you know, chaos in the streets at all times.
Those institutions actually make people intellectually lazy, I think. And you get a lesser population as a result of those institutions. You know, I was talking to somebody who lives in Scandinavia, Sweden, not too long ago, talking about in their lifetime a palpable decrease in the industriousness of the population that lives in this handout system. Where as long as you give 75% of your money away and everything is taken care of for you, you don't have a problem to solve. You know, maybe outside of, you know, personal relationship, shoe untied type problems. But that it is a complete nanny state. After a few generations of that, you don't have a strong industrious population anymore. So we could look out at the United States today, and the people who would counter the self-interest argument that maybe we would make, I think they'd have a good case, because they'd say, all right, well, I look out at America today and you say everyone can just act in their own self-interest. I see that half of the people are obese. You know, this percentage of people are living paycheck to paycheck. These people are in crippling debt. There's, you know, a heroin and opioid epidemic that's
out of control. Yeah, this person that I've kept behind bars for their whole life. See, they don't know how to live free.
Exactly. So it would be hard to walk them back from that to say, no, I think that these phenomena that we see in culture today is a direct result of those imposed systems of top-down control, because it's taking away that rugged individualism that I think people in this country once had. They had to forge their own way. They had to solve their own problems. You know, I mean, I grew up in a fairly well-to-do family. I feel like I had a lot of things handed to me. And, you know, I think I had good parents, but I think I'm worse off for not having to basically cut my own path and find my own way sooner in life.
So this is a good unintentional segue to one of the questions on my scattershot list. How hard is it, because you're an educator, I mean, you love to teach people, you love learning things yourself and helping others have those aha moments, as you said, and you're clearly very good at it. Has it been hard for you to also be an entrepreneur? So in addition to just teaching and engaging ideas, you've had to build a brand, figure out a revenue, you know, system, have a business model. You've got to maintain kind of an operation. You are sort of a company, not just an employee. And I think there's a lot of opportunity there. I think more people who are really good at teaching and sharing ideas should start to look at themselves that way. But I got to imagine it's hard too. I mean, it would have been probably easier for you to just kind of take a job where getting paid and business models and revenue and all that stuff is taken care of by somebody else, and you just have to focus on teaching. How has that been transitioning to being an entrepreneur?
Well, for me, it's been incredibly difficult because I really had no idea how to do it, you know, and I didn't see the value in outsourcing a lot of the responsibilities that still to this day lay in my lap.
Yeah.
You know, automation is another one. And when we did shows on productivity in January, one of my guests actually talked about, you know, how much time he can actually save and free up for creative, bigger picture type work every month just by automating and outsourcing. Mm. And it's hard because a lot of those things, they don't seem like options for me because I'm in the thick of it, you know, like all of this stuff. And I've gotten much, much better in the last couple of years. And my stress level has gone way down trying to make all of this stuff work. But, you know, the advice that I would give to people is, you know, have a nice chunk of change saved if you want, if it's possible. You know, the other advice I have is start really young, you know, like when you're still a teenager and you have the freedom to fail, because, you know, you only have to make sure that your bed is made. You know, you don't have a mortgage, you don't have you know, all of these other obligations. So if you can start doing this stuff before you're 18, that's awesome. But planning ahead you know, when I started doing this, I didn't think it would be a job. I think when I first formulated these ideas, I thought for a moment it was something that I could get rich with somehow. And I thought it would be like as a movie and then like a big School Sucks merchandising empire. But I didn't know anything. So that was how I thought, you know, and as it started to produce a little bit of an income after it grew a substantial following, and then it kind of grew to a size and a scope of responsibilities that didn't really allow me to, like, you know, drive around tutoring anymore as much as I would have liked. I was really kind of blindsided by the opportunity that was presented to me. And I would really suggest that other people do things very differently than how I've done them. I was incredibly naive. I think that's a good title for my autobiography. I was incredibly naive. I thought that it was as simple as, you know, having a fair amount of talent for producing audio or video, getting that product up on the internet, and the rest will take care of itself. And that might have even been more true 6 or 7 years ago when I started, but the market is so crowded now that you really have to know what you're doing, and you really, really have to have an edge. So the preparation would be, you know, financial, having money to invest in an entrepreneurial project, especially if it's something like what I'm doing, because it does cost quite a bit of money to do something like this professionally, but also to have a plan, you know. I just wanted an outlet. I just wanted like an audio video diary. I didn't think about it as much more in the beginning. So, you know, having those things in place, because I see the difference between how things work for me and how things work for people who do similar types of projects, but they did it with a plan right from the beginning. And they knew who they were talking to right from the beginning. You know, they had a clear avatar. They had a clear marketing plan and a clear strategy, and I didn't have any of that. So I'm very lucky to be where I am today, and I think there's a tremendous untapped potential in what I'm doing. But my strongest recommendation would be doing it totally differently.
Okay, I don't want to. I want to be wrapping up in 5 or 10 minutes, let's say. Mm-hmm. But I have half a dozen questions, and I want to try to hit them quick. You ready?
Yeah, sure.
All right. What do you see education looking like in 20 years? I guess there's two questions. What would you like to see, and what do you expect?
That's a great question. Let's start with what I expect. I expect it will look a lot like it does today. No. In 10 years, I think it will look a lot like it does today. In 20 years, I can see the entire higher education system collapsing just because they can't justify it anymore. I think the government schooling K-12 system is more institutionalized and has more political power behind it, or has sufficient political power behind it and is bigger in scope than higher education, that would probably survive a little bit longer. But it's going to be hard for the public school supporters to justify its existence much longer than that. What I would want education to look like is a question I've never answered, because to me, it's answering a question like, what should dinner look like? You know, it should look like whatever the learner needs it to look like, whatever keeps the learner interested, and whatever is generated intrinsically, and whatever keeps each individual motivated. Now, I would amend that a little bit, because I think there obviously are core skills that need to be developed. And I think early in life, it's up to parents to really set the right environment to ensure their sons or daughters will have the ability to read and count and write and things like that. Because those are like really, really foundational skills. And if they're not in place, it's hard to build anything without those core skills. So I think that those are important things, and maybe they even have to be outright instructed in a homeschooling or a private schooling environment. But once a foundation of learning tools is in place, I really believe that kids should be set free to pursue their own intrinsically motivated, you know, explorations.
That partially answers one of the other questions on here, which is, would you say you lean more towards one of these? And these are sort of big bucket approaches, unschooling, homeschooling, something like a Sudbury Valley school, which is basically an unschool school where people, a bunch of kids unschool together more or less, or something like a Montessori school.
I think I lean towards all of them, depending on, you know, who we're talking about and who we're not talking about. I think one student could get value out of all four of them, in a 5-year period. You know, I mean, and I have these conversations with parents all the time. Unschooled my child, didn't really work out. We did more of a structured homeschooling approach. Then they decided they wanted to go to school. I've also heard the exact story in reverse. You know, mm-hmm. We started in public school, then we tried homeschooling, and, you know, that was still too much, structure or limitation. And then we just moved more into an unschooling thing, and that worked out great, and they took off from there. So in any way, I mean, all of those approaches might be different depending on the learner and depending on what point in their learning adventure he or she is in.
I like that answer. Actually, somebody just asked me today, they heard me talking about, sort of unschooling my kids. And he said, I was just talking about the need for intrinsic motivation and self-directed learning. And he said, yeah, that's really cool. But don't you think something, the classroom is valuable for some things? And I was like, you're missing that's a false dichotomy. What I'm interested in is who's the person choosing. And anytime you're forcing your kid to do something, I think it's less valuable when your kid is sort of following their own interest. And if their own interests lead them to a classroom as the best way to gain something that they want, that's great. There's a lot of things that can be gained in that way, but it's more about the source of the motivation to me than it is the medium of learning. Mm. Okay. So what is one question or one topic you wish people would ask you about, but they rarely do?
Video production. Or I get frustrated when I work really hard on the production of my show. You know, I don't think about it as compensation for not being like a genius. Like, I know there's some people who can just turn on the microphone or turn on the camera and shoot for a half an hour and then hit stop and put it right on YouTube.
That's basically what I do.
Yeah. But I don't, and that it's masterful every time. Right.
Oh, well, that's not me, but
I don't have that gift, you know, and I've seen people who do have it, people who can really just riff and rant, but also have it be like, you know, powerful and educational and entertaining. For me, that takes a lot of work. And, you know, I put a lot of work into enhancing my productions, or at least I have with, a lot of productions in the past, audio or video. And somebody will say something to me like, where did you find that montage you used in that show? And I'm like, I made it.
I was going to ask 5 hours. I was going to ask you if you may. I figured you make those.
Yeah. I've even thought about that, like in the production process. Are people not going to know that I made this? And I really like to talk about my creative process in a non-pretentious and self-congratulatory way, but it's kind of tricky to talk about stuff like that and strike the right tone. But I'm proud of the work that I put into this and what the finished product often is. So I wish people talked to me more about the creation process. And I spent a lot of time actually just talking about it in March, so that need was partially satisfied. But it's not even so much like getting questions like, oh, how do you do this? But just having conversations with other people who are doing similar things and kind of shop talking would be really appealing.
Oh, man. You know, it's funny. It sometimes if you're doing something that you're really passionate about that is a process, but it also has content, everyone wants to talk about the content. So like I blog every day and I don't have like a huge audience by any means, but a lot of people will talk about the different things I blog about, but I like talking about the process itself, you know, like, yeah. this is hard work to make myself do this. And like some days I write from inspiration. Some days I have to like go through and make it happen. I want to talk about that. So I think that's really interesting. So speaking of your show, which by the way, you're right to be proud of it. It is very well produced. It's such a pleasure to listen to because there's just so much richness in the production. So kudos to you.
Thanks.
How many hours do you put into a typical episode?
That's a tough question. The best answer I could give would be between 6 and 30. depending on what it is. I mean, most of the shows that I've worked on in 2016.
You're like a marketing freelancer. How long will it take you to do this? Somewhere between 1 and 100 hours.
Yeah, exactly. Most of the shows that I've done this year, I'd say 5 hours per show, but I've also cranked out a lot more of them. Actually, and that's just like the audio version. That wouldn't include if there was a video version. That would be a separate workload.
So when you have a video version, you don't just put up a like picture of you in the studio while you're talking. You add additional stuff to it.
Well, I tried that. I actually had to do video coverage. So I tried to just do like the still, logo or something like that, and put the podcast up on YouTube, and nobody watches those. So I actually did video coverage of me and the guest, you know, shooting myself with a camcorder and shooting the guest with like a screen capture program on Skype, and then merging the two together in Sony Vegas and editing it just a little bit. It's really hard to edit video the way it is, the way you edit audio, because you can see the jumps in video and you can't see them in audio. So sometimes you have to let the ums and ahs go because, you know, there'll be like continuity problems. So video editing is more work than audio editing. And a video presentation for the same podcast could double or maybe even more than double the length of time that it takes to get something like that ready for release.
So are you going to be disappointed when I air this and I don't go back and edit out your ums and ahs?
No, not at all. Not at all. Because I can repost it eventually and I can go back and both of ours.
You can make it sound beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Then I'll start using that. This is my podcast. People will be like, wow, it's so well done. You never stutter. It's great.
Indeed.
What is your favorite kind of episode?
Well, the episodes that I've had the most fun with would be, we do these occasional collaboration shows with this other podcast called Liberty Conspiracy, hosted by this guy, Gardner Goldsmith. And instead of calling it like School Sucks and Liberty Conspiracy, we call it Podcast Masters Liberty Masterclass, which is a very, you know, sort of self-congratulatory, making a ceremony out of this joint production, and quite pretentious. We have some very ostentatious art that goes with it. And we call the episodes masterpieces instead of podcasts. And so like the last one we did was in December, and it was a 4-hour exploration into James Bond and the cultural impact of James Bond, but also the backstory of James Bond and the history of British intelligence and connections to all the way back to like Cecil Rhodes and the Rhodes Roundtables and Atlanticism and, you know, this desire that British intellectuals once had to basically reunify, reassemble the British Empire, including the United States. And, you know, how British intelligence and spying fit into that, and how there was, you know, these subversions of the American intellectuals by the British in World War I and World War II. And we just went everywhere with this. The whole show was 4 hours. It wove these two different storylines, you know, one kind of a reaction to the James Bond film franchise and the other this historical backstory, and the two storylines were kind of interwoven, so we would break away from one and go into the other one. And I just thought it was like a masterful.
Oh, you sold me. Next time I'm traveling, I want to listen to it. Now I'm like totally mesmerized. Are those episodes in your feed for the School Sucks podcast?
Yep, that's episode 399. It's called James Bond, Social Injustice Warrior.
Oh, I love it. I'm gonna go check it out. Okay, final. I got two more questions. One is, what do you wish you could do with the School Sucks project, but you currently lack the time, money, skill, resources?
I would really like to do some really sleek video productions for YouTube or another means of distribution. I'm really hard on myself about the quality And I think there's a lot of skills I need to learn to be able to do better video production, which includes using better equipment to shoot footage and using better editing suites like the professional ones, which I haven't taken the time to learn yet, like Adobe Premiere and Adobe After Effects, stuff like that. As far as the website is concerned, I'd really like to have a rich selection of alternative education courses, things that are really, really helpful to, you know, any of the three avatars to which we try to speak on, you know, self-knowledge, self-education, or self-improvement. You know, that's the mission of School Sucks Project, achieving individual liberty through self-knowledge, self-education, and self-improvement. So I part of the reason why I've organized content the way I have so far this year is because I want someone to come to the front page of that site and just see, oh, in January they talked about productivity. That would help me. Oh, in February they spent the whole month talking about, you know, the principles of learning. That would help me. In March they talked about creativity. That's something that I feel is underdeveloped in my life. And I want to just continue down that track through all of 2016. But I'd eventually like to develop courses that I could sell, you know, as basically, you know, all of this work that's gone into this free content is work that could have been going into creating a revenue stream. And it can probably go in both directions. But, you know, I feel like there's an opportunity to, you know, develop some really valuable courses. So that's something that we've also been exploring early in 2016.
I love it. Brett, final question. What should our listeners do next to engage with you, learn more about what you're up to? Do you have an email list or obviously going to schoolsucksproject.com? Is there anything in particular you'd point them to?
Yeah, I would say go to schoolsucksproject.com and make an account just so you can, you know, be visible there. And they could, in the very near future, they'll be able to join a newsletter and get extra updates from me. But I really want people to explore the podcast. So on the website, you know, there's a list of every series that we've ever done going all the way back to 2009. And I would encourage your listeners to just go and see what interests them and start listening. And check us out on YouTube as well. Maybe you could just start with a video series I did called The Underground History of American Education, which was based on a book of the same title by John Taylor Gatto. And it was a way to – John Taylor Gatto wrote this amazing book that goes through the entire history of the public schooling system in America. And I really wanted to bring it to life and make it accessible to a new audience who probably wasn't going to find it, you know, searching Amazon for educational history. So I cut like 15 or 16 videos that I think are paced a little bit more like movie trailers than, you know, educational history books, somebody reading an educational history book. And I think it's some of the best work that we've done at School Sucks Project. And John also approved of the series. So I would encourage people to check out our video work. You can find it at School Sucks Podcast is our username on YouTube.
Brett, absolutely. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on, and look forward to keeping up with everything that you continue to do.
Yeah, likewise, Isaac. I'm really excited to see where the future of Praxis takes you.
Me too. Well, have a great day, Brett. We'll talk again.
Yep. Thanks.
Today, I am thrilled to be joined by Brett Vinat, who is the founder of the School Sucks Project and the voice of the School Sucks podcast. Brett, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Isaac. It is great to be here.
So today, what I want to do, I want to just go scattershot. I was originally going to do what I typically do, which is kind of go through a chronological, okay, tell us your backstory. How did you get into what you're into now and that kind of thing? But I feel like we have such similar interests, and there's so many places we could go on the topic of sort of education, self-directed learning, and all these things. I just want to jump all over the place, and through the process, we'll get your bio. It will emerge spontaneously. How's that sound?
I love it. Let's do it.
All right. So first, who should listen to the School Sucks podcast?
Well, at this point, I would say it's three groups. When I started the show back in 2009, I was really hunting for frustrated high school students who had, you know, the ability through experience to identify with the show's title. And I wanted to help them make sense of this experience they were having and hopefully offer them some solutions or new directions away from schooling and towards real education. I would say that as the show went on and grew, we also speak to a lot of homeschooling or unschooling parents. And I would say a majority of our audience is made up of adult autodidacts, just people who knew that the, you know, school experience left a lot to be desired as far as, you know, real education was concerned. And they're trying to make their own meaning and educate themselves as adults and de-school. You know, a lot of those non-life-serving lessons that we get in the 15,000 hours of public school.
You know, it's interesting. I've had people tell me before, hey, I think I'm going to start a blog or a podcast, but I can't start it until I pick a theme. And I got to get a name that exactly describes what the theme of this blog or this podcast is going to be. And my response is usually like, I mean, if you want to do that, that's fine. I'm not going to say that's wrong, but my guess is if you just start doing it, you'll find a theme sort of comes in ways you didn't expect. And it seems like, and you got to correct me because I've listened to, I don't know, maybe a couple dozen of your episodes, and I know you have hundreds. It seems like your show has kind of morphed in some ways to be far more than sort of here's what's problematic with school and maybe here's some other ways to think about education. Your show is like an educational program. It's got all kinds of, okay, how to be more productive, how to be more creative. It's got sections on, you know, learning about history. Like it's a combination of sort of the theory of education itself, as well as some ways to just educate that don't involve school. Was that something that you planned or did that just kind of happen?
You know, that's a really good question. I initially thought that the show would be much shorter than it's turned out to be. I originally conceived it as kind of a treatment for a documentary film. From there, I just kind of sat dormant for a couple years. And when I started getting into podcasting, like listening to podcasts, like 2006, 2007, I was like, oh, you know, maybe that's an avenue through which I could pursue this idea. I thought it would be more like an audiobook kind of thing. And maybe, you know, it would be 10 to 20 episodes and I could go over everything that had built up inside me from my 10 plus years experience at that point, working in and around schooling, you know, as a private school teacher, as a public school tutor, SAT tutor, college consultant. I ran a tutoring business in New Hampshire where I live for a few years. So there's a lot of things through those vocations that I can't just say because I won't have my job anymore or people won't want to come to me. If I tell them the truth about you know, the whole college experience and how much sense college makes, I won't be a college consultant anymore. The word of mouth will not, you know, that word of mouth business spreading effect that we kind of rely on in that business, that wouldn't be working for me if I was completely forthright with people. So a lot of things had built up in me, and I really didn't like the fact that getting work in that field was largely based on what I couldn't say. So the show became a nice outlet for that. And then after I did, you know, 10, 15 episodes, I said, I like this. The show actually became fairly popular relatively quickly thanks to other people getting involved in interviewing me, like Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain Radio, and then some people affiliated with the talk show Free Talk Live started listening and promoting it. And we built up a pretty big audience by the end of 2009 after we'd only been doing the show for a few months. And I said, well, why would I stop this? And when we start to go away from, yeah, school sucks, here's the problems with school, and into, but, you know, education is wonderful and lifelong and enriching. There's really no end in sight. So, yeah, I think I wanted to originally record so I could hear myself, you know, complain all this stuff that I'd been like jotting down in notebooks or that had been swirling around in my head. I just needed an outlet to get it out. So it was very negative about, you know, the hidden lessons of school, the damaging public school history curricula. And after I got through all of that stuff, people said, hey, you know, you should talk about this. And I said, you know what, I should talk about that. And it just continued on and started to, you know, pick up momentum from there for the next couple of years anyway. So you that know, was the beginning.
It's exciting to hear that it, I was going to ask you about if it took a long time to build up an audience, but that it took off relatively fast. And I got to say, the name is just so great. Like when you hear it, oh, the School Sucks podcast, I want to know what this is about. You know, it's intriguing. It's nice and edgy. Did you feel, so I've talked to so many people over the years, whether they're working in some, you know, government bureaucracy or some, you know, political capacity, heaven forbid, or in a, in an educational system, and they kind of see what's around them and they don't like it, but they feel trapped. It sounds like you were kind of in that position where you kind of, you started to dislike what it was you were doing for people. And I'm sure you were able to do some good in that, but just sort of the overall system you were working within. Did you feel trapped? Did you feel like I'm just going to be stuck here forever, even though I don't really believe in this system? Or did you feel hopeful? And what was that like kind of making the transition out of that?
Yeah, that's interesting. It all happened very, very gradually. And I think one concern that I had, you know, it's to be completely honest, I didn't have, you know, a 5-year plan at any point in my life. That's kind of a new concept to me professionally.
The Soviets were famous for those, and look where it got
them. Right. I didn't know how I was going to make more money in education than I was making at the time. That private tutoring enterprise or college consulting, it pays very well for someone with my, you know, education and skill level. So I didn't really want to walk away from it, but
was primarily helping people get better scores on tests and get in college entrance exams.
Yeah, and you know, I think that is a totally reasonable profession. I didn't really have any hang-ups about doing that because the SAT tutoring business, which is a majority of the work that I did, it's very competitive. There's a lot of companies, even just here in New Hampshire, that are doing that and trying to make deals with public schools for, you know, exclusivity and tutoring their students. And the edge that I tried to give our company was the SAT as an opportunity. And I was actually pretty forthright when I would talk to guidance counselors or teachers or school administrators, both public and private. And I would say, I feel, this is from my experience as a student and my experience as a teacher, that the schooling process leaves a lot of really core, valuable intellectual skills underdeveloped. Even after all this time, 12 years, critical thinking skills, vocabulary skills, argumentation, persuasion. And I think the test, if somebody properly prepares for it, there's opportunities in this test to develop those skills relatively quickly and to make those skills that are being developed just really for the test, to make that explicit, there's a better chance that kids can retain them beyond just, you know, getting those 2 or 3 numbers that they need to put on a college application. So I would be very clear, like, you know, we're talking about writing an essay, but there's a, you know, strategy for persuasive writing or argumentation generally. There's fallacies that you want to avoid. And I was always like improving the course as it went on. Like every time I taught it, I felt like I would add more to it. But all anyone was really using it for, this was the sense that I got, was to get into college. And they really didn't care about anything else I was saying. I mean,
your magic ticket, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there were some times where kids were like, oh, that's really cool. Thanks for sharing that. But I felt like so many of the students that I taught were already so overwhelmed with the demands that school was placing on them that they weren't going to just drop everything to have this really enriching investigation into the opportunities that the SAT might provide. I think I feel like I helped a lot of students. I know that a lot of them got much better test scores afterwards than they were getting before. And I felt good about that. And like I said, the business spread by word of mouth. But by 2013, the show had just become such a responsibility that I really couldn't. I had to pick one thing to succeed at, basically, or at least with the skills that I had at the time. I mean, maybe I can, you know, develop in the realm of organization or time management or productivity where I could do both of those things somehow simultaneously. But at the time, you know, like almost 3 years ago, I felt like I really had to make a choice between one or the other. Even though School Sucks was a lot less security, I chose to go down that route because I saw it as, you know, I guess, at the time, I would have said something like a more noble path to go down.
You know, it's interesting you mention some of the students you worked with kind of just being too stressed or worried about getting into college to be able to sort of stop and take advantage of some of the other value they could have gotten out of that time. I kind of see it as like it's like Maslow's hierarchy, right? You have food, shelter, water, and then you have get a college degree. And it's so, I find so many young people, they say, yeah, I know, like there are things I could do to sort of make myself more valuable or discover what I really love and kind of pursue things. And I know those have long-term benefits, but I can't think about anything until I get that degree need satisfied because there's so much pressure on them. And it kind of blinds them to the actual opportunities around them because they feel like they literally won't survive if they don't just get that credential under their belt and like whatever it takes to get it. And only then can you think about, just like if you're starving, you're not thinking about, you know, conserving the rainforest, you're thinking about living. And only after you've met that basic need can you sort of move up. And I feel like it's become such a worry, such a source of anxiety for young people to get the best grades, to get into the best schools, to just get that out of the way. Okay, then I can think about becoming the kind of person I want to become, which is really sad, I think.
Yeah, and I felt like if I was going to be honest with kids at the end, I was really only going to add to the pressure, because with what's happened in higher education, quote unquote, in the last 15 years, at least since I've graduated from college, is that it's much easier to go to college than it used to be. Certainly, like than it was 30 or 40 years ago. It wasn't so common, you know, and a lot of college professors are complaining about the lack of skills that their students have in college today. So my best advice for a lot of these students who are just looking at college is like the 13th grade. It's an expensive way to explore career options, especially, you know, some of these kids looking at schools. And this was, you know, 7-8 years ago that I was doing this, and schools were like $20,000 to $30,000 a year in tuition then if you're going to live there. Yeah. So I would say if you want college to be worth something, and this kind of goes to adding on to the pressure, you really have to go to one of the best schools. Like, you can't just go to college and get a bachelor's degree. Like, I graduated from college in the year 2000. That wasn't even true for me then.
Yeah.
You know, never mind today. I mean, I walked out of college with that thing and I thought there would just walk into a job interview, get a job. I thought I would be choosing between jobs that I had been offered, you know, and it's not like that's completely untrue. Like, I did get offered entry level jobs that paid like, you know, $22,000 a year in 2001, $24,000 a year in like marketing. My first professional job using my degree paid $23,500 a year. And it was a marketing coordinator at a ski resort. I got a walkie talkie. I got a digital camera, which was very hip at the time. And a four-wheeler, and in the winter, a snowmobile. So it was a pretty sweet job, but it only paid $23,500. And I thought, you know, I was just stunned by how little I knew about the work world. I thought I would be getting offers at like $40,000, $50,000 to start with a degree, considering the fact that I had just dumped $60,000 into the education, but that's not how it worked.
It's amazing. I think I had to look up the statistics to verify, but the last time I checked, something like 60% or more than 60% of degree holders are either unemployed or working a job that doesn't require a degree right now. So there's some degree inflation out there. Okay, let me ask you this, totally changing subjects.
Sure.
About libertarians, because you mentioned some of the different sort of libertarian shows that brought you on early on, and that's a realm. I mean, I've very familiar with. I've worked with some great organizations you know, sort of in the broad libertarian milieu, and that's kind of my those are my people. That's my stomping grounds. But there's something really interesting. Why do so many libertarians sort of miss it on education? Like, they might be in favor of, you know, sort of school choice or vouchers or better run government schools, but there's not a lot of fundamental questioning of school itself as a vehicle for learning. Why do you think that is?
I don't think people see it as like an entertaining or exciting or attractive issue. School. I mean, think about like what most people's most people who graduated from high school in America, what do you think their attitude is towards high school? Like something they want to revisit and explore? I think that's a big part of it. I think that there's other issues, especially like in current events and politics, that are much more alluring than the examination of government school. You know, I was really pleased to find that the history of government school was absolutely fascinating via the work of people like John Taylor Gatto, yeah, and Charlotte Iserby and a few others. So I found that there was a lot of interesting material to go through. And I think that's been one of the reasons why the show has been successful with libertarians. I think initially, too, getting the Free Domain Radio audience on board back in 2009, 2010 was really helpful because a lot of their content at the time was focused on a better, freer society through the treatment of children and respect for children. Mm. And the school issue fit perfectly with that. So there was a real powerful alliance that was formed with a lot of those listeners who saw the importance of parenting in raising people who basically speak the language of freedom, not people who speak this language of, you know, do this or else, the language of authority, basically. So I, as I look out at the libertarian landscape, I don't see why energy, and this is, you know, maybe certainly subjective and probably a little self-interested, I don't see why there's any focus on anything else besides education and parenting.
Yeah, it's, you know? It's interesting. It's kind of a similar intellectual as well as career journey that I sort of took in trying to figure out how to make the world a better, freer place. Okay, there's politics. I found out pretty quickly that doesn't work. And then sort of, you know, policy, a little bit maybe, educating people and sort of trying to convince them of the ideas of liberty. Okay, there's some small percentage of people who will change their beliefs based on, you know, ideas and direct argument. And I think beliefs are the ultimate binding constraint of what politicians can get away with. But it took me a long time to realize that the role of experiences, which is where I think parenting, education, entrepreneurship, which I'm all excited about, come in. You can create experiences for people, and based on those experiences, they will form beliefs, and it doesn't even necessarily require direct argumentation. There's a great story of an interview of somebody, he's like a captain in the American Revolution, and someone interviewed him and said, why were you fighting? Did you read, you know, Thomas Paine? Was it John Locke? Was it, you know, what ideas influenced you to fight this battle? And he said, we didn't really read books where I was from. We had the Bible sitting around, but it wasn't really any theories or anything. We had always been free. And when someone came and said, we're going to start taxing you and start doing this, that was offensive to me. And I think that's such a beautiful picture of you don't even necessarily need, even though I'm a huge fan and I nerd out on Austrian economics and all this stuff, you don't even necessarily need everyone to understand, you know, the deadweight losses that are created by government cartels or whatever. If someone has grown up where they are respected and largely autonomous and they're not constantly subjected to arbitrary authority and just taught to follow the rules no matter what, the first time somebody tries to tell them that they can't have a big sized soda at 7-Eleven, they're going to be offended by that just based on their experience. They're going to say, well, that's bull crap. You know, I've experienced something better. This isn't right. But if they've grown up accustomed to just always obeying authority and getting rewarded for following the rules, they're going to be much more prone to go along with that kind of stuff. And it's too late to win the intellectual battle in many cases. So I think it's just such a powerful reframing of how to make the world freer is by starting with making your own life, your own family as free as possible. And people who have tasted it will not want to give it up.
Absolutely. I think when children are raised from a very early age in an authoritarian setting, they'll be marched off to the government schools at the age of six, and that environment will make perfect sense. And after they spend 12 years in that authoritarian environment, they will go out and be citizens. And based on their previous experience, that world will make perfect sense. So, yeah, I think that's exactly what you're saying. And that is one of schools' claims. We prepare young people for citizenship. They certainly do, you know, especially in this world where people are told that they're not safe from themselves, they're not safe from each other, they need to be watched, they need to be monitored, nobody can be trusted, you must listen to authority, do not question authority. Yeah, school definitely, I think, delivers on that claim that it makes good citizens. It certainly does.
So you are always, you're an avid learner, an autodidact, you're constantly diving into new things. What are some ideas, books, or concepts currently that you're really interested in, that you're digging into right now?
Oh, that's kind of embarrassing because on my show, we do theme months. So I said, we'll do three theme months, and then I'm going to take a month off to just kind of have fun, you know, and not, I'm trying to put together theme months like mini courses. So when people come to SchoolSucksProject.com, they can see the value. All through January, we focused on maximizing productivity, largely through the work of people like David Allen, who wrote the book Getting Things Done. In February, I teamed up with a rationalist philosopher named Steve Patterson, and we did a series called The Principles.
Steve's a great, great friend of mine. He's been on the show a few times.
Oh, terrific. Yeah, we did a series called The Principles of Learning Anything. All throughout the month of March, I did a series called The Creative Pursuit, where I talked to people like, let's see, Dobby Barker, who's a libertarian graphic designer, Julia Toryanskaya, who's a very well-known Canadian libertarian YouTuber, Jeffrey Tucker, he's currently working with Fee, but obviously Jeffrey's got a long history of publishing, and he's authored several books. David Allen, who came on to talk about his productivity method for creativity, and a few others as well. So that was the first quarter of 2016, and I spent a lot of time immersed in books like The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield.
Oh my gosh, that's one of my absolute favorites. I recommend that to people all the time.
Yep, but a lot of productivity stuff as well, and I was really immersed in Steve's work through the month of February. So then I said, what's a fun thing that we can do for people for April? And people have been just clamoring in my Facebook group for more conspiracy shows. And I said, what if we did an investigation into Hollywood symbolism and like the hidden history or the dark history of Hollywood? Now, there's a lot of silly stuff there, but there's a lot of interesting stuff there as well. So last year in August, I had teamed up with a couple other libertarian media people, Brian Sovereign, who does a show called Sovereign Tech. It's an awesome, awesome tech show. And he used to be one of the hosts of Free Talk Live. And Stephanie Murphy, his partner, she's done a bunch of libertarian podcasts. She also used to host Free Talk Live. She's a voice actor now. And we did this thing called Conspirathon, where we just went all over the map for hours talking about and kind of bringing a critical thinking approach to conspiracy narratives. So because this was so popular, I said, let's do it again. Let's spend the month of April doing that. But let's really, really focus in on Hollywood. What did Stanley Kubrick mean in The Shining when he did this? Or what is Eyes Wide Shut really about? And what other movies have hidden messages? And what's the story behind Hollywood? Why is it so weird there? What's going on there? So where I've actually been spending a lot of time like watching documentaries, and I'm actually reading a book right now by Robert Anton Wilson just to get me in the mood. It's called,
man.
Illuminatus.
Yes. Yep. He's so fun. What was the one that I read? I think it was maybe The Cosmic Trigger. I don't know.
Cosmic
Trigger. He's a lot of fun. You know, this is so funny you mentioned this because my good friend, TK Coleman, he's also the education director for Praxis, and he's a frequent guest on here, but he loves all kinds of ideas in all kinds of fields. He loves exploring conspiracy theories, and he's been saying for a while, oh, we should do an episode about conspiracy theories. But the problem is you can't really do one about them without people being like, you're a conspiracy theorist. And he's like, the reason I want to do one is I want to sort of make the claim that engaging with conspiracy theories is actually a productive pursuit because it makes you a better thinker. So no claims about the truth or falsehood of these. Most of them are crazy and most of them are, you know, probably false. But the point is to just say, oh, well, you know, I know there's not an alien satellite on the moon because I just know it because smart people say it, is not as valuable as saying, okay, let's entertain this. If there were, what would that mean? How would it be proven or disproven? And kind of forcing yourself to give better reasons for the beliefs that you have. And it's not so much about, like, you know, deciding that there's an alien satellite on the moon and what would that even change if you did decide that. It's more about forcing yourself to be more rigorous in your thinking, even on things that seem really obvious and they're so commonly accepted. Nobody but wacky people questions them. Just getting a little bit more willing to question and push yourself to have actual, you know, sort of arguments for things. So anyway, it's funny that you bring that up.
Well, it's a great learning opportunity, and I think that's what you're getting at. But I definitely second that. I mentioned Kubrick a few minutes ago, and you know, one of the greatest conspiracy theories of all time is that the Apollo missions were not real, and Stanley Kubrick filmed them for NASA. There is no conspiracy in the world that I want to believe more than that. You know, that's so entertaining, but I just can't believe it. The evidence just isn't there, unfortunately. You know, we did a series called Logic Saves Lives, and we did an episode about conspiracy theories. This was back in 2012. And that was one of the episodes that we did. Did Stanley Kubrick help NASA fake the moon landing? I sure hope so. But in the end, it turns out that most conspiracy theories are really just built on fallacies of omission. People really shining the spotlight on certain aspects of a story that they want you to see, but leaving other areas that would be really, really important to illuminate completely in the darkness. And the other problem, it's not just intellectual. I think it's also really emotional, that whole conspiracy investigation. People bring tons of confirmation bias to that. They go there wanting to believe, and that desire
and
will
on both
shut
sides
down.
Too, yeah. I will say, many of the people who argue against the conspiracy theorists, even though they're usually right, they often don't have arguments either.
They're some of the most frustrating people I've ever listened to. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is funny. I started thinking about conspiracy theory as a vehicle for learning. I was in Ecuador recently, and I was like, hey, we're right at the equator. And I started thinking about the way the Earth spins and, like, thinking, you know, I know very little about physics, but, like, so it should be spinning faster at the equator. So I started looking some stuff up, and inevitably a whole bunch of the results were all these flat Earth conspiracy theorists about, you know, the Earth is flat and here's the proof and blah, blah. So I actually watched some of these videos and read some of this stuff. I spent more hours than I care to admit. And what was interesting is in the few hours that I sort of engaged some of these flat Earth claims mentally, I was able to, you know, relatively easily refute them and just like, okay, well, this is not a good argument, the logic here. But what I noticed was I learned more in those few hours of attempting to refute the claim that the Earth is flat, or attempting to show, okay, what would it take to disprove this, about physics and, you know, the way that the Earth moves and all these different things, than I could ever learn if someone just told me, here's the way the Earth moves, here's how it rotates, you know, here's the relationship to gravity, blah, 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 memorize these facts. Compare that to being told, I'm going to claim the Earth is flat, it's your job to disprove me, right? Like, there's something so much more fun and engaging in approaching learning in that way. So maybe there's more gold to be gotten out of the exploration of conspiracy theories.
Oh, there's a ton. You know, I was working as a facilitator for this boy. This was maybe back in 2011. So it was while I was doing the show, and he had been pulled out of public school. He had some challenges. He just didn't really fit in there. He was like 8 or 9 years old, 9 or 10 years old at the time. He was absolutely obsessed with the show Ancient Aliens on the History Channel, not on the Sci-Fi Channel. This was on the History Channel, that, you know, human civilization was basically pushed forward by some kind of alien presence. That's the basic thesis that these pseudoscientists keep coming back to on the show. And I said, okay, well, you know, this is where his enthusiasm is. So I could get a curriculum from his public school, and I could pull him away from his YouTube or the pictures that he wants to draw, or the UFO books that he wants to read. And we could do math at home, or reading at home, or science or social studies at home. Or I can just ride this wave of enthusiasm that he's already on, and we can see what kind of educational opportunities exist inside it. And there were so many. I mean, we, you know, learned about GPS, like plotting all of the places in the on the globe. This was like a month-long project where there had been UFO sightings or UFO abductions, and he learned about like GPS and longitude and latitude. And that's really, I think, that for real education to happen, you have to use the enthusiasm and the motivation of the learner. And that was actually, he was the one who talked me into, isn't this moon landing thing interesting? Because I said, that's the silliest conspiracy theory. But then after we like we watched something, I was like, that is at least worth investigating. And I did, like, the more I learned about it eventually, I was like, okay, I guess I was right when I knew nothing, but that was just luck. But yeah, you're right. There are a ton of educational opportunities in those investigations.
So you're a huge lover of history, and that was kind of is that what you taught?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And what is your why I'll go put it this way. Why is history valuable? And what do you love about it?
It's interesting. I think that I want people in my audience, and this was definitely true when I was a teacher, to have these moments where they're like, no way. You know, this is the same appeal that I think a lot of these people promoting conspiracies have, is they want to shock people with new knowledge. And I just remember being in college and having a real like left-wing history professor, and he was, you know, teaching basically the Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky view on America in the 19th and 20th century. And I was just stunned and really like angered by this empty Disney version of history that I had gotten in public school. And I really want to, you know, wake people up from that. And I remember, like, every time I can make a connection or tell a story, and I can just see, if I can do it face to face, and I can see the look on somebody's face when they're like, wow, the most boring subject in school is actually interesting. I think today, like, a lot of people know this now. Like 20 years ago, maybe a lot of people didn't. But with the internet, the amount of really fascinating explorations in, you know, American and world history that are possible, it's much clearer today. Like when I was a freshman, or when was I took history, maybe like sophomore, junior year in college for the first time. So 20 years old, late 90s. I was just stunned. And I want more people to have that kind of waking up experience to just how fascinating this stuff is.
I'm going to ask you a monumental feat, considering the work that people like John Taylor Gatto have done. I know you've done a lot of work on this as well, but give us a history of schooling in just like a couple minutes.
Yeah. The best place to start would be the beginning of the 1800s in Central Europe, primarily in the Kingdom of Prussia. And the Prussian aristocracy was interested in expanding their small kingdom. And as they expanded to the west, they bumped into the French and Napoleon. And they suffered a few really, really embarrassing military defeats. One of the most noteworthy was in a place called Jena. And it was so devastating for the Kingdom of Prussia that their intellectuals, there was one philosopher, he was kind of not exactly a student of Immanuel Kant, but like he wanted to be an imitator of Immanuel Kant, and his name was Johann Fichte. And he wrote something, I think it was called The Address to the German Nation. And basically what his prescription was, a kind of schooling system that would put into the people a sense of nationalism, a collective identity that they could fight for. The Prussian military was very, very undisciplined because they did common sense things. Like if a stranger who you've never had a problem with starts shooting at you, and it, you know, it's a bunch of them and you're in a field, well, just get the hell out of that field as quickly as possible. You know, don't shoot back and just run, drop whatever you're holding and run. So they had a kind of a fire discipline problem that the aristocrats were hoping the schooling system would solve. And that's actually how government schooling, compulsion schooling, began in the Western world. I mean, there were other versions of it, and you could trace it back all the way to ancient Greece to not the Athenians, who were the really
Spartans.
Yeah, exactly. In the 1850s, as America was starting to accept immigrants and as slavery was coming to an end, there were a lot of academics and intellectuals who were looking for, you know, a similar kind of homogenizing institution in this country. And Horace Mann and a handful of others, Horace Mann is considered to be, at least this is what I learned in graduate school, the father of American public education. He went to Central Europe. He went to Prussia. And he said, well, this system is great. We should bring this to America. But sure, yeah, it's a little authoritarian. We can use it, though, to just, you know, ensure the continuance of our republican institutions or something like that. And the system starts its importation to the United States, first to Massachusetts, and then other states quickly adopt it. Mann, interestingly enough, never even saw the Prussian schools in session. He was there during the harvest vacation, basically. So he never even saw the schools operate. He just basically toured the grounds and talked to administrators. And that system caught on, making public schooling an institution, a permanent fixture in American life. And by the time we get to the 20th century, there's, you know, we're two generations into its existence, a group of progressive reformers come along, people like John Dewey, people who we would today call socialists, who want the schools to basically produce their vision of society in the adult world. And, you know, this is also pretty dark. You have people getting involved in the schools and meddling in the schools who are interested in things like eugenics and sterilization. Most of the eugenics programs that were implemented back, you know, it was like education came here from Central Europe, existed for a couple of generations. The American intellectuals embrace it. They develop eugenics, send it back, kind of like a Yankee swap, to Central Europe, where it's unfortunately and tragically implemented in the 1930s and the 1940s. But those ideas originated here with American progressives, and those were the people meddling with the schools in the first few decades of the 1900s. So I certainly left out a lot of details, but that's how it became a fixed compulsory institution in the United States between 1850 and, say, 1920.
That was a very good job of doing that so quickly.
It was cool having Stephanie, who hasn't seen a couple of the movies, so we can build a bridge between our conversation and maybe the people who want to listen to this podcast but haven't seen the movies in a long time or haven't seen the movies ever. And then I said to you, how are we going to explain the plot of 2001? Or how are we going to explain, once we've kind of been through it so many times, how do you explain the plot of The Shining? The Shining, I think, is the movie where it's most like, well, what was the movie about? Even the top layer, the layer like, this is a movie about a guy who goes to a place and then a thing happens. And
I think we should start out with that, because that's like, yeah, you know, we'll go from most basic or straightforward and move to the more esoteric.
Yeah, but it's interesting because it's almost like a challenge to, with these three films especially that we're going to talk about, to just say, okay, the top layer is clearly this.
Right.
Because the top layer is so porous, almost like inviting you to go beneath it. Like, the top layer is just like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
You know? So before we get to the first movie, just to go back to your question, Stephanie, I think there's one more theme, and this one is a little more subtle, usually.
Okay.
That runs through every movie that he made after 2001.
Okay.
Minds under control. Now, sometimes it's very subtle and only a part of the movie. Sometimes it is the movie, like Clockwork Orange, is about mind control or mind washing, reprogramming somebody. Barry Lyndon, it appears in his seduction of that woman. In The Shining, it appears that at times Jack Nicholson's character, has control over his wife, over his son. It appears that the hotel
or whatever the spirits are that, you know, possess the hotel itself have control over Jack. Full Metal Jacket, again, Full Metal Jacket's kind of the wild card. And I have to admit, I haven't seen Full Metal Jacket in probably 15 years. I'm sure if I watched it again.
I can tell you as a person that was in the military.
Yeah.
Like, they really are trying to change your mind. Like, mm-hmm. you need to stop thinking as an individual. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely a basic concept of that organization. So
yeah.
I don't think that's a stretch.
Okay. And Eyes Wide Shut, there's the obvious example in the beginning where the Hungarian, I forget what his name is. I'll bring up his name when we actually get to Eyes Wide Shut. But he basically hypnotizes Alice, the Nicole Kidman character, using neuro-linguistic programming to where she almost very clearly appears to be in a hypnotic trance. And she has almost been convinced to go off and sleep with this man, even though she's married. But then there's something else that never occurred to me until I rewatched the movie a couple weeks ago. He did have what I would call a Dave Chappelle-esque suspicion about Hollywood. He thought it was a very corrupt place, and he didn't want to spend a lot of time there, and he didn't want to work inside that system. And I think Spartacus was a very informative experience because that was totally inside the Hollywood studio system where he saw people meddling in his work and changing things. But I think there's some kind of deeper corruption that he also became aware of. Now, he was a very voracious reader. And like you said, he was very interested in the Nazis and the Holocaust. And if you're voracious enough in those pursuits, you're going to come across the occult.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know? So I think now
we covered that in the previous Conspirathon, didn't we? Somewhere in this series, we talked about the connection between Nazis and the occult.
We just touched it.
Yeah.
Barely. We just kind of skimmed the surface of it. Yeah. I will say this. There are a lot of Kubrick conspiracies. And one of the common threads that runs through at least many of them is this idea that Kubrick was privied to something, that somewhere powerful people recognized his talents and they wanted to use him, or they wanted to bring him into something.
Mm-hmm. And he didn't want to be, he wasn't having it.
No, that ultimately he wasn't having it. But at first he was seduced by something.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people center this, and this is not any kind of spoiler because it's been covered on School Sucks before. I believe it's episode 175, but it's called Did Stanley Kubrick Help NASA Fake the Moon Landing? I Sure Hope So. That's part
I remember that episode well. Yeah, I listened to it. I love that one.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of people have speculated that 2001 was a kind of test run for some of the photographic trickery that they would be doing in what most Americans believe is the Apollo moon landing footage. One of the most comparatively credible proponents of this theory is this guy, Jay Widener, who's done a lot of research and he's written a lot of articles. I think he's even made a couple documentaries about it, done a lot of interviews. You can find Jay Widener being interviewed about this all over the place. That Kubrick was brought into a kind of secret society of sorts, or at least into the power structure, you know, where things were revealed to him through this process, this very secretive operation. And ultimately slowly he kind of rejected it. Now, there is this very interesting thing.